Hey guys, welcome to the Next Level Agents podcast. I am your host, Kevin Kaufman, and along with my business partner and co-host, Fred Weaver, we bring to you our podcast all about getting to the next level. Sometimes we talk to real estate agents, sometimes brokers, sometimes people just in and around our space, and sometimes just entrepreneurs in general. But our point here is to talk to the brightest and the best and to pull gold nuggets out of them and bring them to you so that way you can take little actionable pieces of advice, sometimes big actionable pieces of advice, and make your business even better and help you get to the next level. Do me a favor, if you haven't already, go over to ratethispodcast.com. ratethispodcast.com/NLA stands for Next Level Agents. And please leave us a 5-star review if you have not already. All right, without further ado, welcome to today's episode. I'm super excited that you're here. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. Morgan, this is my business partner, Fred. He and I are the ones this was Fred's idea, our book club, and super glad that we could have you be a part of it.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
We're going to jump into it. Guys, listeners that are in, feel free. Some of you have already sent in questions. Please feel free to type them in, and Fred and I will do our best. Typically, what happens with these is we get going in a good conversation, and quite frankly, we don't get to all the questions, but I did have some that were submitted early, and so I will use those, as well as the ones that Fred and I have for Morgan as well. First of all, Morgan, I just want to again say thank you for taking time out of your schedule to do this with us today. We, Fred and I, and a bunch of our friends just read your latest book, which I'll speak for myself. I loved, thought it was great. And I thought it was, if you could have written a follow-up to Psychology of Money, this seems like the appropriate follow-up for it.
Thanks.
Kudos to you on that. I only read 50 pages of it because I could have sworn, I heard you said on average, that's what the bestsellers get. Was that, did I hear you say that at some point?
Yeah, that's about right. There was a mathematician, I forget from what school, but he did a study 10 years ago or so where using Kindle highlight data, when you highlight a passage in Kindle, you use that as a proxy for how far people made it. Once they stop highlighting, they probably stop reading. And he showed that even among the best-selling books, like the mega bestseller books, most people make it like a quarter of the way through before they stop.
Isn't that wild?
It's wild. And I think most people hear that and they're like, yes, that maps with my experience. It's true for me too. There's books that I recommend to people and I'm like, oh, you got to read this book. It's great. That I read half of, but I still love it. But it, because it's, you made a really good point and I love this point and more people need to hear this point, but I get it. You don't need to keep giving me 75,000 examples of it. And so a lot of that is just the economics of the book industry. A lot of readers would say, I would love if a publisher published a 75-page book, but publishers will never do that because you can't charge enough to cover the costs. Books are not a great business. Amazon takes 50 to 60% of the revenue, which by the way, they deserve because they do so much of the work and deliver it to your doorstep in one day. And then print costs, distribution costs, marketing costs, whatnot. It's not a very high margin business. So if you are publishing a 75-page book and you had to price it at $5 or $6, it just wouldn't work. So you have to charge $20 to $30 for a book. And most people are going to demand 200 or 300 pages for that product.
That's so simple. To me, that this could almost be, maybe it's a blog, maybe this will go on your blog, but this could almost be another subject for you. Is we know the good stuff is in that first 50, I'll call it 50 to 100 pages, or at least most books I've read, even the great ones, could probably be reduced down a little bit to your point of, okay, we got the main point of it and it was fantastic. Yet overall as public, we're going to demand 200 or 300 or 400 pages if we're going to pay that full freight of $29.99 for a book.
Exactly. And I've tried to combat that. I'm not going to say I've done a perfect job at this, but I've tried to combat it by saying, I want to have, rather than a book that's about one topic, I want a book that has a connective theme, but every chapter could be read independently. You could start the book on chapter 17 and it'll make sense to you because every chapter is an independent story. And I think that's the anecdote for nonfiction for making it work at least 90% of the time. Like, I made this like kind of jerk point one time. I'm like, the Declaration of Independence is 4,000 words. Don't tell me that you need 70,000 words to explain interest rates this year or something like that. It's just excessive rambling. And yeah, so I think the only way to combat that is just by making every chapter independent.
Yeah, I like that. And it's funny, I've heard you say that before, specifically talking about your books. And I think about some of my other favorite books, and a lot of them are like that, where you really could just pick up and read a chapter. And I'd never considered that. So I appreciate you doing that.
And so much of it too, if I could add one more point, so much of it too is if you come across a chapter that you don't like, it's fine. Just skip it. Move on to the next. Find one that you do. But if the book is, if the chapters are sequential, you can't do that. Because if you miss one chapter, the next one's not going to make sense to you.
Yeah, very true. One of the things that I've heard you talk about recently, and I feel like maybe it's not highlighted, but I would love some more in-depth thoughts from you on this. I hear a lot. So we sell real estate, and most of the people listening to this also sell real estate. We hear a lot about inflation and the cost of housing, and that's real. But I've heard you in the past talk about that, yes, it costs more, but we talk about how much bigger homes are today, say, than they were 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. Can you go deeper on that for me? Because in one hand, when I read something about how is the average person supposed to keep up, and I certainly feel that for a lot, especially for a lot of our clients. And then on the other hand, I think about, but we have so much more these days.
Yeah. So you often hear, and it's true, these are accurate numbers, that home prices adjusted for inflation, like real home prices, are twice as expensive, if not more today than they were when baby boomers were buying homes in the 70s, 80s, 90s. That's true. But as you just hinted at, these are very different homes that we're buying. To take it back further, in the 1950s, the average new construction house was 950 square feet and had one bathroom. And by the way, that was when people had bigger families. So the white picket fence, Americana, Leave It to Beaver family in the 50s that we have nostalgia for, they had 3 to 4 kids. Their house was 900 square feet and they had one bathroom. But yes, it was cheap. Even adjusted for inflation, it was much cheaper. But compare that today, the average new construction house today is, I believe, I don't want to have false precision here, but I believe it's 2,700 square feet is the median new construction house today. And it's 4 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms. Completely different product than what you're getting. So that's when you have a false comparison when you look at historical home prices in the United States. These are not the same products we're getting. By the way, it's the same for most products. Like the average automobile, even like an entry-level Honda Civic today, has so many more bells and whistles than a brand new Cadillac did in the 1950s. You can't compare it whatsoever. And so it's not the same product. Yeah, and even if you're looking at something intangible, like what is the safety of a new Honda Civic today relative to a new Chevy in the 1950s? Like you are so much more likely to live because we have airbags and better seatbelts, whatever it might be. And so they're just not the same product. So tracking inflation historically is a smart thing to do to understand how you keep up and whatnot, but you have to adjust it for all these things. And by the way, not to get too technical here, but the CPI, the consumer price index that everyone cites, they do that. They do adjust for quality, and it pisses a lot of people off because when they look at like the price of computers, they adjust that for the fact that the computer has twice as much RAM today than it did 10 years ago. So a lot of people think that is like fiddling behind the scenes to massage the numbers. But I actually think you have to do that to get a good sense of what inflation has done over time.
Yeah, that's a great point. And my grandfather recently passed away, and my uncle and aunt had to sold his house finally. And thinking about it, I know that he paid $19,500 for it. And they sold it for about $1 million, by the way, but it was 1,000 square feet, 3 bedroom, 1.5 bath. That was, it felt, and now I'm thinking about it, it did feel tiny, but it was such a, you just brought that to life for me. Really? Wow. That really hits home for me.
Our last house that we lived in Virginia, it was built in 1936. And the one thing I remember about it, the master bathroom was the size of a small coat closet. And that was normal in the 1930s. And if you built a new house today with that master bathroom, you would not be able to sell it. People would just be like, what the heck is this? There's no way this is going to work.
It's so funny how time, and this is, I think, been a theme of your writing, is like the time and the expectations that we have has just continued to grow. Yes, things are more expensive, but our expectations and what we're willing to accept as consumers has continued. That demand has only gone up.
And in so many ways, that's great. The fact that people wake up every morning and say, what I have is not enough, it's inadequate, is what drives progress. That's what drives people to innovate. And they say, I need to go build my own business to get rich. I need to solve a problem. Like the feeling of that what we have is not enough is what drives society. And it's wonderful. But it also creates this truth that has always been true that I highlight in the book, which is that you can have a lot of society progress and growth and prosperity, and nobody feels any better for it because they expected all of it. And using homes is a perfect example. the people in the 1950s who were moving into a 900 square foot house with one bathroom were stoked. They thought it was great. They were thrilled. A lot of that is because so many of those people had just lived through World War II and the Great Depression. And maybe in the Great Depression, they were literally living in what was called a Hooverville, like a corrugated steel shack that they threw together during the Depression. So this slapped together 900 square foot home was pure luxury to them. But then when your expectations inflate over time, then now all of a sudden the 2,700 square foot house with three bedrooms and way more amenities doesn't feel that great at all. And you can imagine a world in which our grandkids are living in such a better world. They're earning twice as much money than us. They're living longer than us. They have access to better medical technology. Go on down the list, their world is better and they're no happier for it because those things become par for the course. Take something simple like Advil. Nobody wakes up in the morning and, I am so grateful to live in a world that has Advil. Everyone just takes it for granted. But John D. Rockefeller, the richest man in human history, never had Advil. When he got a headache, he just grinned and bared it. It was a thing. So you have all these technologies that are like so incredible that we don't spend 1 second being grateful for because we just accept them as a normal part of the world. And you could imagine that happening with technologies. Let's say that there is a cure for cancer in the next 50 years, that we have actually been able to extinguish all forms of cancer. I don't know if that's going to happen, but let's imagine for a second. You can imagine a world in which our grandkids and our great-grandkids don't appreciate that because cancer is just not a thing, in the same way that polio is not really a thing for you and I today. And so luxuries become necessities very quickly. And it creates a world where even if everything gets better, we're at this like stable level of happiness and contentment and contentedness.
Yeah, that is so good. And great point. I want to shift to, you shared, I think it was on Tim Ferriss, about a family that you got to, I think you're doing a project with them, they were worth a lot of money, $8 billion, if I remember the number correctly. And you were astonished at how, I'm going to use the word normal, I'm not putting that on you, but at how normal that they were and they interacted. I'm curious, what were the lessons that you took away from that whether you, it was something you're able to bring home? And because I know I've heard you talk a lot, I think about this a lot, and so does Fred and many of our friends, of how do we teach our kids? How do we give them a better life than we had? And also make sure our kids grow up as well adjusted as possible. What are some of the lessons you maybe took away from that family and even some of your other research and work that you have been able to apply in your household?
Yeah. So a very quick background, this family, their net worth was $8 billion and they were completely anonymous. You Google their name, nothing comes up. There's no pictures of them at fundraisers. They're not on any Forbes list, even though they should be. They have gone, and that's very intentional, they've gone out of their way with God knows what kind of legal resources to scrub themselves from the public record and become completely anonymous. They donate their money anonymously. And what's interesting about it is that this family, if I told you the name of the business that they owned, you would know it. It's a household name and it's an ethical business. It's not like they're trying to hide anything, but I think they know better than almost every other billionaire out there that fame and people knowing how rich you are is a liability. It's a social liability that's going to drag you down because people treat you differently because they want your money. They're going to suck up to you. They're not going to tell you the truth. They're going to try to extort you. Go on down the list. Being famous for how much money you have is a terrible thing. And because of that, at least a part of that, I was doing some work for them, particularly their grandkids who were in their early to mid 20s, let's say. And they were the most, and by the way, the grandkids have access to unlimited money. They're like, they can buy anything they want. And they do. These people live a very grand life. They have private jets and mansions all over the world. But these kids were so down to earth and likable. And I'm just sitting there having dinner with them. I was like, I like all you guys. Which is extremely rare for somebody like that. It is much more common, through no fault of the kid in that situation, to be a spoiled little jerk. And again, through no fault, if you grow up in that, that's what it is. I was having another conversation with a separate guy just about a month ago who is about my age, and his father is a multi-billionaire and has been for a long time. So this guy who's in his late 30s, early 40s, grew up as the child of a billionaire with private jets and mansions and the whole thing. And he too is very down to earth, extremely grounded. And so he and I were talking about why that is. And he said it was because despite having so much, money was never part of the family culture. It was not that they woke up talking about money and talked about how much money they have and how they're so much better and richer than other people. It was just not part of the culture. And he said something I thought was really profound. He said, the reason that spoiled brats exist is by and large because they come from a family that is obsessed with money. The family's always talking about money. They're always talking about how to get more money. They're always talking about how they are better than other people because they have more money. That's what creates a spoiled brat. But if you are a multi-billionaire and you just don't talk about it, yes, of course you have nice homes and nice cars and you have servants and private jets, but it's never discussed. In the same way that you and I have unlimited oxygen that we can breathe, but we never talk about it. It's just a thing that's always there in abundance. And I thought that was really profound. And he said, a lot of the reason that those families are rich is because they're obsessed with money. It's cause and effect. The parents wake up every day just thinking money, 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 money. And that influences their children. Where if you are rich, but you wake up every morning and you're like, I want to teach my kids good values and how to be a good citizen and how to be a good spouse and a good parent, that value will rub across them as well. So that was, for a long time, my thought about money and kids was, if you don't want to spoil your kids, give them less money. And this guy who actually called me a month ago said, I heard you say that on a podcast and I disagree with you, because you can give your kids a lot of money, but if you're still teaching them the good values about what money cannot do for becoming a good person, that's what the kids will take away. So that was literally just in the last couple of weeks, maybe like a little bit of a shift in my mindset. Because my wife and I think about this. Our kids are 4 and 8. And we are not billionaires, of course, but we try to want to think about, like, how can we raise kids to, how can we use our money to benefit them, as every parent wants to do, to open doors for them without creating spoiled little jerks. And I think that's something we think a lot about too, is even if we might have a little bit more money than other people, don't ever talk about it. Or even if you're talking about it, do never frame it in the sense of, we are luckier, we are better, we're more fortunate, we are superior to them, because we're not. I think that's, maybe that's cliche to say, but I think that's the balance you need to strike.
Yeah, I think it is a balance. I know you're very aware of this book too, Die with Zero. I read Psychology of Money and Die with Zero, not quite back to back, but it was probably the year I read them, which had been about 2 years ago.
They were released in the same week, ironically.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
No kidding. Okay, so I read them and I would say that those were my two favorite books on the subject of money. And in a lot of ways, they're very different. Bill's really good at spending, honorable billionaire. And you're bringing home this lesson of, hey, let's think long range and very, I'm going to use the word conservative. And as different as they could be, to me, they're the perfect complement. So I love that you shifted, because I'll be frank and listening, I've listened to a lot of your interviews just for my own reasons, but also in prepping for this. And that was something that didn't sit as well with me either. And so I love that you added that bit of new context to that. That's really cool.
Yeah. I would also say too, that I agree with at least 90% of Bill's book. I think it's a great book. And I don't think that it conflicts with at least much of what I've written throughout my day. And obviously I learned a lot from that book too, particularly as my wife and I think about our own children. Do we want to make them wait until we die to get money? Or do we want to help them benefit when it matters most, which is probably when they're in their 30s and 40s, trying to buy a home and put their own kids through college and whatnot? That's like that. It's such a simple statement. But when you say it like that, of course, I don't want to, like, what kind of world is it? I'm going to make you wait until I die to give you money that I don't need, but you do. Come on, that's what you're going to do? It doesn't make much sense. So Bill wrote a phenomenal book.
Yeah, I honestly, anytime somebody asks me about money books specifically, those are the two I recommend, and I recommend them both. I love that. I just love that you've added that in there, that last story. I'm going to switch to a couple of questions we got from some of our book club members. This one is from my friend Eric. He asked, can you share any specific strategies or a mindset approach around managing expectations? I'm going to add my context, as you've talked about you quote Munger a lot, obviously, and the key is being low expectations or no expectations. How do you think about that question and how you manage expectations?
The first thing I'd say is there's two things to start this. One, much easier said than done. Humans are naturally evolved to raise expectations because life is a competition for resources. At its core, that's what it is. And if somebody else has more than you, it's an evolutionary prerogative to say, if that person has more, I need to chase them and become and get more than them. So this is not an easy thing to do in any sense. The other thing is, I think everyone's different and hardwired. And there are a lot of people in society that can never manage their expectations. The extreme examples of this, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, all those guys. Elon Musk has been a decabillionaire since his early 30s. And still today, when he's worth $200 billion, I think he wakes up every morning saying, I need more. I need bigger goals. I need more audacity. I'm not taking enough risks. Because that's just in his DNA. Where someone like myself, I would have shut everything down years and years ago if I had those kind of reasons. So some people, I'm so glad that they exist in society because we benefit from them. But a lot of people cannot manage their expectations. I think it's just not how they're wired. To me, the only thing that's worked is identifying and understanding the expectations game that is played in society, which is that a lot of what people are driven to do is to make money so that they can buy things to impress other people. And then when you realize that those other people are not even paying attention to you because they're worried about themselves, they're thinking about themselves, they're worried about showing off to other people, they're not thinking about you, they're thinking about themselves. When you identify that game, you're like, this is a silly game. And why am I playing it? Why am I spending my one precious life stressed out to make money, to show off to other people who are not paying attention? Now, some people are paying attention to you, your spouse, your kids, your family. Like, those are the people who you want to impress. Everybody else is like a dumb game that when you identify the game, like, why am I doing this? I wrote about this in Psychology of Money, that I was a valet at a 5-star hotel in Los Angeles during college. And I realized I was young, I was 19 or 20. But when somebody would drive into the hotel in a Lamborghini or a Ferrari, never once did I look at the driver and say, whoa, that guy is cool. What I did is I imagined myself as the driver. And I said, if I was a driver, people would think I'm cool. And it was like, wait a minute, don't you see like how dumb this is? I never think about the driver, but I want to be the driver so people will think about me. It doesn't make any sense. Like, everybody is so self-centered, naturally, innocently, in that way, to assume that everybody's looking at you when they're not. And so that, to me, once you identify that game, I think your aspirations for showing off to strangers plunges. And you start focusing more on the internal benchmark of like, how can I use money to actually do something that's going to make me happy rather than putting up my peacock feathers for other people who aren't even looking? Somebody explained this recently that was so smart. They said, a high-end Toyota is a nicer car than an entry-level BMW, because the high-end Toyota is filled with things that make driving pleasant for you. Cushy seats and a great sound system and like a moonroof, like whatever it is. The entry-level BMW is just bragging rights. It's just showing off. It's not a great car by any means, but you get the emblem on the hood that shows other people that you're cool and you're rich and you're successful. And I think that's a great philosophy for life. Like, you want to go through every aspect of life, not just cars, but shooting for the high-end Toyota, where it's not that expensive, it's not flashy, but it's filled with things that are going to make your life better. I think you can apply that structure to homes, careers, vacations. Do you know how many people vacation in Bali? Not because Bali is amazing, because it's really not, but because people think it's amazing. So when you put it on Instagram, they're like, wow, you went to Bali. I think it applies to so many things where you're just doing this for the attention of other people. Once you do that, your aspirations plunge. And once your aspirations plunge, it's easier to keep your expectations in check.
Now, this is definitely way oversimplified, but just the way I think, what I heard is, as soon as I start to make sure I'm aware and that I've got awareness of this, that's really like the first step in being able to manage these expectations. Because I'm aware that's the game that's going on around me and that I am playing to some extent, it's now a much easier lever for me to pull.
Yeah, totally. I'll give you a real world example of this. My wife and I were just looking just in the last week at a high-end Toyota SUV, and Lexus, which is of course owned by Toyota. They have the exact same car with the Lexus emblem, and it's $35,000 more. And there could not be any difference between, they are the identical car, not just on the outside of the chassis of it, but like on the inside, it's the same car. And then, so you pay $35,000 for the Lexus emblem. A lot of people are willing to do that, but that's, I think, the perfect example of that $35,000 is you chasing something that honestly people don't really care about. No one's paying attention to your Lexus on it. So I think that it's a great analogy for how a lot of things work in life.
That's amazing. Our friend Matt's got a question. I'm going to read it verbatim and I'm going to add some context to it as well. He said, if we find ourselves in a place of comfort or success in our business, what are some ways to create the stress or necessity for innovation without sacrificing the wealth and comfort? The reason I like that question is I've heard you talk a lot. It's not really like I'm after this $1 billion. You're after the ability to work because you want to work. And yeah. I think sometimes that can definitely feel like maybe too much comfort in life. Do you feel that way? And to Matt's question, if so, what are some ways you maybe create some stress for yourself so you can get back into that, I'll call it working, or just that I got to get stuff done mindset?
I think rather than intentionally creating stress, and I think this advice that I'm about to give applies to like half of people. This is not universal advice for people, but I think most people, well, not most, but about half of people in their career should have a more well-defined exit strategy. Because what happens, particularly for a lot of entrepreneurs, not necessarily salaried workers, but self-employed entrepreneurs, is what made you successful was the stress that you had of waking up every morning and being like, I got to make this business work. I need to work really hard or else this thing's going to fail. Once you reach a level of success where you're not that stressed anymore, you're not that worried, that's when you're in trouble. Because the thing that made you great is now gone. And that's when a lot of businesses fall into misery and go out of business. The only way to combat that for a lot of these people is to have an exit strategy where the day you realize that you're becoming fat, happy, and lazy in your business, you need to get out. You need to leave. You need to get the heck out of there. I use this quote and same as ever from Seinfeld, who Jerry Seinfeld pulled the plug on his show when it was at its peak. It was doing better than ever before. And he said, we're done. Pull the plug on this. And later he said, you only know where the top is if you experience the decline. And he said, I had no interest in experiencing the decline. So I had to pull the plug at the top. And you can do that when you're a zillionaire, of course. But I think that is a great philosophy that more people should pay attention to. I do this with my own career. I will not be writing books like this forever. And there'll be a time where I say, look, I've accomplished a lot of what I want to accomplish. I'm going to move on to the next phase of my life. Like having a well-defined exit strategy is good. Because I guess to get back to your question, I think it's very difficult to implement artificial stress to keep you motivated in life. Once you realize that you're not as stressed as you need that you used to be, realize A, how dangerous that is, and B, that the only solution is to move on to something else in your life.
That's impactful. Thank you. I want to switch to another topic I've heard you chat about a little bit, and I'd love to know how this is evolving for you, but you've talked about yours and your wife's desire to be able to give away money. You use the term micro philanthropy, if I wrote that down correctly.
Yeah.
You shared an example once about helping a single mom and a small child at a CVS. I'm curious, maybe for the listeners, if we could just share that story quickly, but also, have you been able to expand on that? Because you also mentioned in a talk previously that giving away money can actually be more difficult than it seems like.
It's actually very hard. And I would define micro philanthropy as macro philanthropy is like you give money to the Red Cross, a great organization worthy of your money. But I think as a donor, at least in my perspective, I feel like I'm just donating to a black box. I don't know where this money's going. I trust that you're going to do a good job with it, but who is it helping? I don't know. I don't know. Whereas micro philanthropy is there is no matter where you live, there is a single mom who lives within 5 miles of you who is about to be evicted with her two small children. And the $1,000 that you give her can utterly, completely change the course of her life. And you're going to know it. You're going to see the look on her face. You're going to understand how impactful it is. So I've always been much more interested in micro philanthropy, but I've had a couple of instances of trying it where you realize how hard it is. One was at CVS many years ago. The other, this is about 2 years ago, where my wife and I were walking into a Target where we live. And there was a mom on the corner holding a sign that says, need money for food. And she had a child with her who looked exactly like our son. So just this empathy that I had because he looked like my son, as silly as that sounds, it was just like, I can't fathom not being able to feed my son. How terrible is that? So we instantly knew we're going to help this woman. And we're not going to give her $5. We're going to give her much more than that. Went into the ATM, got the money, came out and gave it to her. She took the money and zero response, no response whatsoever. No thank you, no eye contact, no nothing. And it was interesting because I was not doing this for the thank you. I was not doing this for my own good. But what I realized is that we got no feedback from her that this worked, that this helped. Now, of course, you could also say that somebody in that situation who can't feed her kids does not have the capacity for emotion to say, oh, thank you so much. This is so great. I'm sure she's depressed, etc. But it's hard to keep doing something when you don't get any feedback that it worked. Now, just to clarify, we have continued doing things like this because we're not doing it for our own good. We're doing it for them. But feedback that what you're doing is working is a critical part of any endeavor. Bill Gates, I think with his philanthropy, the Gates Foundation, has taken the most data-centric approach to philanthropy that anyone has. And his approach was, the majority of philanthropy doesn't work very well. So we need to do philanthropy where we can very clearly measure the impact that we're having. And we're only going to give money to things where we can measure. By giving $1 here, we improved this outcome by 10% or whatever. And when you don't get that kind of feedback from people, it's hard to know, what do I do next? Because in that situation, I felt so terrible, like putting the blame on this mother. But if we got feedback of how impactful this was, we might be more willing to do more of it. That's a terrible thing. I hope you understand the context of what I mean there. Yeah. But that's why microphilanthropy is so difficult, because the feedback loop is more difficult than you would think it would be.
Yeah. I think about there's a lot of people hurting, period. And you see a lot of GoFundMes for different things. And some I feel I'll say pulled to want to donate. And when I feel that, I just do it without even thinking twice, just give. But you're right. There's almost never a feedback loop on that. And I could see how if there was a feedback loop, like you feel good about it, I would think that it would rev up your engine to want to go do it again tomorrow.
Yes. And sometimes I've thought maybe that's why macro philanthropy is better, because once you give money, you're not like, hey, did it work? What did that person do with the money? You just give money to the Red Cross and you're like, I trust you to do the best. And maybe that is a better model, because you don't have to worry about the feedback loop. You just trust another expert to do it for you.
Switching gears, something that you've said both in the book and in different interviews over the years came in the form of a few questions, both for myself and some of our book club members, but had to do with the power of telling stories. I love the example you gave of the book Sapiens and how much better of a job at storytelling that was done. Can you expand on the storytelling? And I'm curious if you've got any tools or wisdom or insight on how to become a better storyteller.
Yeah. So the book Sapiens is a fascinating example. It's the best-selling nonfiction book written in modern times. I think it's sold 30 million copies. And it really pisses off a lot of academic anthropologists and historians, because there is nothing new in that book. He did not break any new ground. He didn't find any new, there's no new discoveries. And the author would admit them himself. There's nothing new in the book. He just took what everyone else has already written and wrote his own version of it. But the reason it sold so well is because it's so well written. It's so readable. And you compare that to most academic anthropology books that you can't get through two pages of it without your head exploding. And it's just so dry and so dull. Sapiens is just a captivating story. You start reading it, you can't put it down. It's so great. But I think that model of, it's not the person who has the best answer or the new answer or even the right answer. The person who tells the best story is who gets everyone's attention. And you see this a lot in politics, obviously, where on either party, this is not a partisan thing. It's not the person who comes up with the best policy. It's a person who tells the best story that gets people's attention. Like every successful politician has always been like that. And every once in a while, a really smart policy wonk come along, but they're not charismatic. They're nerds. They can't raise any money. They go nowhere. Nobody's going to vote for that person. Who they vote for is the person who pounds the table and is very charismatic. It's all about storytelling. The other example that I love from this is Ken Burns, who makes the best documentaries on US history. His documentary in 1990 on the Civil War, more Americans watched it that year when it came out than watched the Super Bowl, which is astounding for like a historical documentary, that it brought together the entire nation to watch this thing. And it's 14 hours long. And this too, there's no new information in there. Everybody knows how the story ends. Everyone knows what happened in the Civil War. It's the most documented period of American history, perhaps. But Ken Burns is the best storyteller of filmmaking history. And he had this interview many years ago where he talks about his storytelling process. And he said, when he's making a documentary, he will literally alter the script of the narrator so that a specific word is said at the very moment that there is a specific beat in the background music. He will align the script to the background music so that those things, like when the narrator says a very emotional word, there's a powerful beat in the background music. And that's why it's so good. It's just like that attention to detail about the story. And compare that to your average academic historian who's writing white papers that are written in a like with verbiage that nobody can even understand. It's just so dense and dry and boring. And that's why Ken Burns gets ahead. That's why he is more popular than the Super Bowl when his documentary comes out. It's just storytelling. And so I think no matter what profession you're in, that applies. It's not the best answer. It's not the right answer. It's the best story. Now, once in a while, you get someone who has the right answer and is the best storyteller. Steve Jobs is a good example of that. Steve Jobs built the best product and told the best story about it. That's why Apple is what it is. But understanding that stories are more powerful statistics than statistics applies to every single field. Your doctor is another example. Everyone knows bedside manner is a critical component of delivering good medicine. And if you are a doctor who is charismatic and kind and has empathy, you're going to do better than the doctor who might have a better answer than you, but patients don't trust because they're so dry and boring and stern. So it applies to every field.
That's so true. I've heard you say my forecasting model is good enough, which I love. And because most forecasting models don't seem to work, I'm reminded of a friend, Adam Robinson, who has talked about maybe the worst people ever at forecasting the economy or economists. And he's not even joking. And so you really brought that up for me when I heard you say that. Tell me more about having just a good enough approach to forecasting.
I'll give you a specific example in the stock market. Every January, the chief market strategists from every Wall Street bank, who are like the chief stock market gurus from the biggest banks, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, they put out their annual forecast of what the S&P 500 is going to do that year. All of them do this every January. So there's a lot of data that you can track over time. If you look historically at how all those chief market strategists have done, the average divergence between their forecast and what the market actually does is, I don't know if I'm getting these numbers exactly right, but it's like the divergence is 4% per year. So let's say that in a given year, they say it's going to go up 10% and it actually goes up 14%. So they're off by 4 percentage points. If instead of following those strategists, you just assume that the S&P 500 goes up by its average, its historical average every single year, your annual error rate there will be like 2.5%. It's better. You have a more accurate forecast to just assume the market is going to go up by its historic norms than you do if you follow the advice of the smartest, best paid Wall Street strategists that exist in the world. And so that's an example of just good enough, like just assuming that the S&P 500 is going to go up by its historic average. By the way, it's not. It's almost never going to go up by its historic average. It's always going to be way above that or way below that. But assuming that it's going to go up by its average is good enough. It's better than the people who try really hard. We're actually pretty good at forecasting the weather, but you can imagine 40 years ago, we were not. So the weatherman who said tomorrow it's going to be 73, that was dangerous. What you should have said is tomorrow it's going to be between 70 and 80. And that's good enough. That's good. You can figure out what clothes to wear if I say it's going to be between 70 and 80. So I think a lot of things in life are like that, like predicting the next recession. When's it going to happen? I have no idea. You have no idea. Nobody has any idea. But historically, there have been on average 2 recessions per decade, one of which is usually pretty bad. And that's my good enough forecast. I expect that to be the case going forward. Over the next 10 years, I expect there to be at least 2 recessions, one of which is really bad. That's good enough. And so I think a lot of forecasting is false precision in order to reduce uncertainty that you have in your head. Because everybody would love it if somebody could tell you the next recession is going to occur next May. That's great. You can prepare for that, but it's false precision. And even though if it feels better by reducing uncertainty, I think you are much closer to reality if you just have a good enough philosophy in your forecasting.
Yeah, I think if we take that into account, then I believe this is your advice, and correct me if I'm probably just paraphrasing, but save a pessimist, invest like an optimist, plan like a pessimist, dream like an optimist. If we do that with that good enough model there that you just spoke about, things are probably going to be okay.
Things will work out for you. I think there's a lot of things in life, particularly for people who live in a first world industrial country, that if you just stay out of trouble and align yourself with how the universe works, you're going to do just fine over time. It's just staying out of trouble that you need to do. And a lot of people get into trouble, particularly in finance, when they rely on overly precise forecasts. Because if you believe your forecast that says there's going to be a recession next May, if you believe that, you might sell all of your stocks, you might do this and that. And then when it doesn't come true, you're screwed. Whereas if you have a good enough forecast of, look, there's going to be recessions, but I don't know when they're going to happen. What that means is that I have a fair amount of cash and liquidity and I avoid debt, but I'm not pretending that I know when it's going to happen. I just have an asset allocation that can endure it whenever it does happen. It's just a much more realistic way to deal with risk.
Love that. Something else about risk that really strikes with me, and this was in, I want to say, your latest podcast. One of the cool things to know would be, what if we could see luck? What if we knew where luck was involved? Because then luck can be good and bad, obviously. Can you expand on that and just the thought of where luck's involved and where I think maybe some people probably acknowledge the luck that we've had or haven't had, and maybe others don't as much, and how that might come back to hurt them?
I think there's a thing with a lot of things in life where people are very cognizant of risk and they tend to completely ignore luck. So when a risk happens to it and you're like, oh, 9/11, Pearl Harbor, COVID, these things were risks and they impacted me for bad reasons. But luck, they tend to ignore because people don't want to think that they were lucky. They want to think that all of their success had to do with things that they, like their own actions, their own decisions. But even if you say something as simple as, you and I are white males born in America in the late 20th century, there is an element of luck to that you and I had no control over. It is pure luck. It's nothing that we did. But let's not pretend that if you and I were born in Somalia in 1820, that we would have had the same lives. If something that we had no control over whatsoever had gone differently, we would have very different lives. And so people are very good at ignoring the amount of luck that they have. And I in Psychology of Money, I use the example of Bill Gates, who went to the only high school in America that had a computer. Did that, was there was just this ridiculous, like one in a million stroke of luck that he experienced. Now, was he hardworking? Yes. Was he innovative? Of course. Was he more resourceful than everybody else who went to that high school? Yes. He is all of those things. But he had this ridiculous stroke of luck that if he hadn't had, his life would have turned out very differently. And Daniel Kahneman, the psychologist, makes his point where he says, the higher the degree of success, always without exception, the higher there is a source of luck that played a role. Not 100%. It's almost never 100%, with the exception of lottery winners, but it's always there. And the problem is that we look at the people, we tend to say the opposite. We tend to look at the people who are extremely successful and say, what can I learn from them? What did they do that I can do so I become more like them? And that's almost the exact opposite takeaway that you want. If you want to learn skills that are replicable from people, you need to look at like the middle of the road median or upper median success, because people like the successful doctor probably has a lot of skills that you can learn from. The billionaire entrepreneur probably does not. The billionaire entrepreneur probably had more of his success attributable to luck than the successful doctor did. And so it's almost the exact opposite of what we want. But I think just acknowledging that luck plays a role in everybody's success, particularly the higher that you get, just makes you more cognizant of it in a way that like people know risk. They have risk-adjusted returns and they hire risk analysts and risk consultants. And I think more people should do that equivalent for something like luck. What happened in the past that was out of my control that contributed to my success that I cannot replicate in the future? It's really important to be aware of what those things are.
Yeah, I love that. Speaking of luck, and I'm going to tie this into history. I was at a conversation that Ryan Holiday and Robert Greene were having late last year. And they talked about how, I'm not sure they used the word luck, but how differently things could have turned out in this world had something not happened. And Robert used the example of when Genghis Khan died and his army had to retreat out of respect for their religion and the way they process and grieve when somebody dies. And it stopped, I believe it was Vienna, from being attacked, which could have changed the rest of human history. You've recently told the story of Washington's troops and were on the verge of, they were almost done and had the wind changed directions and had the army been able to just go north, I think it was, they would have been able, things would have been completely different. What are you just, I know you're into history. What makes you look at things like that? And what are some more fascinating, I'll call it, chances of luck that you've come across in your research?
I think it's astounding and it's so humbling to read history and you come across something tiny infinitesimal that nobody thought of at the time that utterly changed history forever. So the example from Washington was during the Battle of Long Island during the Revolutionary War, where George Washington and his troops were cornered by the British, and all the British had to do was sail up the East River in New York. Washington would have been quartered and it would have all been over. The British would have won the Revolutionary War. There'd be no United States of America. It didn't happen because the winds changed direction and the British could not sail up the East River because the winds were blowing the other way, which gave Washington just enough time to get away and regroup, and the rest was history. And so David McCullough, the great historian, was asked by Charlie Rose. He said, Charlie Rose said, if the winds were blowing in the other direction that night, would there be a United States of America? Without hesitation, David McCullough says, no, it all would have been over if that would have happened. And so something as fundamental as the existence of this country relied on the direction of the winds in Long Island on some random day in the late 1700s. And so when history is that fragile, it just makes you so humble about what else could have changed. The other thing, the other story that I use in the book that's always just struck with me is after Franklin Roosevelt was elected, but before he was inaugurated, he was at some event in Miami and a crazy guy in the crowd was trying to assassinate him. Rose's gun fired 5 shots. The mayor of Chicago was standing next to FDR. He took the bullet and died. FDR was not hit, got away, and the rest was history. If the bullet was 6 inches to the other direction and FDR died, as the rules were back then, the vice president elect would have automatically become president. The vice president back then was completely against virtually every New Deal policy that FDR put into place. So these New Deal policies that you and I are still impacted by, for better or worse, depending on how you view it, would have never happened. And the entire course of history would have changed if we had no deal. By the way, if we didn't have a new deal, how America fared in World War II would have been very different because our industrial base would have been in shambles in the late 1930s. We couldn't have built all the tanks and ships and planes that we did. Everything would have changed if this bullet from this 19-year-old was 6 inches to the other direction. And so not only does it happen at the macro level like that, it happens at the individual level. There is somebody who this morning, if they left their home for the office at 7:52 instead of 7:53, would have died in a car accident. And there's also a person who, because they left at 7:53 instead of 7:52, did die in a car accident. And so everything is so fragile like that. And I think when you see examples of how fragile history can be, it makes you more humble to think that we can predict what the world's going to look like in the future. Think about a world in which on September 11th, the security guards at Boston Logan Airport said, hey, you guys can't bring box cutter knives on the plane. What would that have done if 9/11 was forestalled? Let me give you one quick example of this. Because of 9/11, the Federal Reserve slashed interest rates because they thought it was going to really impact the economy. Because they slashed interest rates, we had a housing bubble. Because we had a housing bubble, we had the 2008 financial crisis. Because we had the 2008 financial crisis, the economy was in such shambles that a lot of people during that era, when they couldn't find jobs, went to college and went to grad school because they couldn't find jobs. So now you have trillions of dollars of student debt today because of a terrorist attack 22 years ago. So when you have, like, when you see how those events compound of a TSA guard who could have obtained a box cutter knife, and then 20 years later, you have $1 trillion of student debt. Then there's a direct connection between those two things. It makes you so humble on who is to fool themselves that we know what the world's going to look like 20 years from now.
Yeah, no kidding. Jeez. We got a few minutes left. I'm going to read another question we've got from one of our book club members. Morgan, what are the six, I'm not going to hold you to six, or more books on history that you recommend reading that have directly influenced your thought process for this book and continue to help your thinking today?
Six would be tough because the truth is there would be 50, but obviously I'm not going to name those. I'll tell you one. I think it's one of the best. Here's three, actually. I'll give you three very good U.S. history books. One is written by, or two of them are written by a historian named Jay Winnick. His last name is W-I-N-I-K, I believe. And I think Jay Winnick is the best U.S. history writer out there. He wrote a book called 1944 and another book called April 1965. 1944 is really about, it's a World War II book, but it really centers on what did we in the United States know about the Holocaust? And we didn't do anything because of it. We knew the Holocaust was taking place and we actively made a decision to not do anything about it. He goes into those details and it's astounding, but it's also just a book about World War II and everything that happened, but it's so well written. And his book, April 1865, is about the end of the Civil War and then Lincoln's assassination. And it's very similar. Lincoln's assassination is another thing of, like, if it didn't happen, the entire course of US history would have been changed. And he's such a good writer. Both are sounding. The other is a book by Doris Kearns Goodwin called No Ordinary Time. And it's about Franklin Roosevelt during World War II, but particularly, like, it's a World War II book that has nothing to do with the battles. It's about what FDR dealt with in the political realm and the personal realm, like how he handled the stress and the pressure and responsibility of managing World War II. And I always use that book of, I think the book is 700 pages and not a single sentence could be removed. It's 700 pages and there is zero fluff in that book. Every paragraph you'd learn something from, every paragraph needs to be there. It's just an amazing sense of writing that I always use as example of being brief does not mean being short. Like Doris Kearns Goodwin is a very brief writer. There's no fluff, but it's 700 pages long. It's an astounding book.
Fantastic. Last one I'm going to ask is personal. And Fred, if you want to chime in with one, go for it. But you've told the story about a 19-year-old NBA player and how he tells the story of, listen, when you first get paid tens of millions of dollars and you're from the inner city, that's not your money. And from that is the social debt that comes with money. I'm curious, did you give him any advice or feedback from them? And if you didn't, would you now? And what would it be?
No, I didn't give him any advice because that was a moment where I was like, look, I'm here as a consultant, but I just learned something that I didn't know. And you clearly have more experience and wisdom on this topic than I do. So there's some moments where you just need to learn to shut up and nod your head and say, thank you. That's an astounding point of view. So I think there's a lot of, I think it's always dangerous when you consider yourself an expert, because when you label yourself that, almost by definition, you want to stop learning from people who you feel are below you. And so this was a perfect situation where it was like, wow, I came out of this consulting session learning more than you guys did. But I think that concept of social debt, where if you earn money, the people around you are going to expect more things from you. And to give more context on that, it was someone who said, look, the reason that professional athletes go bankrupt is not because they bought themselves a mansion. It's because they have so much pressure to buy their fifth cousin a house, the fifth cousin who they don't even know. They have so much pressure to take care of the inner city community that a lot of them came from, that the social pressure that they have to blow this money, that's what causes them to go bankrupt. And I think that can be true for a lot of things, for a lot of people, not just professional athletes, but the social pressure that we have to live a certain life when we make a certain amount of money is a form of debt that we don't think of. It's not on our balance sheet, but you see this a lot of, okay, now that you're a doctor, you're supposed to live like a doctor, which means sending your kids to private school and living in a big house and going on nice vacations, a lot of which a lot of doctors can't afford. It's just an amount, it's just this social debt that's hanging over them that causes a lot of financial distress, no matter how much money you make.
Fantastic. Fred, you got anything you want to add before we wrap up, buddy?
I'll just, no, in the sake of time, Morgan, I'll just say thank you for, there was two things that stood out in the book that continually have me thinking. One was the expiring information versus permanent information. And I just took that to heart as far as what am I focusing on and where am I putting my time and energy? And then I just want to say those questions that you left in the back of the book are incredible. I've listened to them a couple of times. I've read them a couple of times and I plan to revisit them. So I just want to say thank you. I think not taking anything away from everything else in the book, but those questions that you left at the end, I think will be something that will live with me going forward. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. No, thanks for that. There are several people who said they wish I put those questions at the beginning of the book, because that was the best part of the book, but I leave them for the very end.
I like it. It's a test to see who got past page 50.
Exactly. We'll see who highlights them in their Kindle reader, right?
Exactly.
That's awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to the next book. I haven't heard what it's about, and you probably don't want to let out any hints on that, but I know you're working on it, and I'm definitely looking forward to it. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Morgan. And thanks for all the book club members who took time out to be here with us today, and talk to you again another time.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
Thank you for tuning in to today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you're looking for even more valuable content and resources to help you grow your business, then we invite you to join our community, Next Level Agents at eXp Realty. By joining us, you'll gain access to exclusive benefits like live trainings, events, masterminds, weekly Zooms, digital downloads, and so much more, all designed to help you grow your business. To learn more and become a part of our community, simply visit kevinandfred.com/contact and get in touch with us today. Of course, if you're not quite ready to take the plunge and join our community, that's no problem at all. You can still access all of our great content for free right here on this podcast. And again, we thank you for listening. We look forward to continuing to bring you valuable insights and more advice in the future.